Everybody, my name is Ryan White, and welcome back to the series Marriage as a Covenant. This is part two of this series. Remember, we're going to be going into quite a few many parts, probably about six different parts of the series, each part having a couple videos in each of those parts. Now, in the first part of the series, which was Your Wife by Covenant, we went into the book of Malachi, into Peter, and really delved into what marriage is, and determined that not only is marriage a covenant, but according to Malachi and 1 Peter 3, if there's problems in your marriage, if you're acting incorrectly towards your spouse, Yahweh does not accept your offerings or your prayers. So it's very important to have an open relationship, open communication, and have shalom in the home, peace in your home. That is the most important thing. Because when there's a peaceful home and your marriage is operating in the manner that Yahweh intends it to, then He can pour out His blessings. Then He hears your prayers. Then He answers your prayers. So it's extremely important. So if this is so important to our Father, wouldn't it make sense that He would have put in His Bible, especially right near the front of it, right, the first thing people read, a message about how our marriages should be? Well, after a little bit of studying, well, you know, by a little bit, I mean probably a couple months of studying, I came across this stuff in Genesis 2 and 3 that has simply blown my mind on how we're supposed to behave. Genesis 2 is all about the ideal marriage. And while, you know, we're probably never going to achieve the ideal marriage in this lifetime, it's a goal that we should always strive towards, right? Just like the Torah, we know that we're never going to live perfectly according to the Torah, but we should always strive towards that. And any time that we make a mistake, we need to pick ourselves up and continue going towards that goal. So Genesis 2 is all about how the perfect marriage is supposed to be. And then in Genesis 3, it's all about a failed marriage and then Yahweh's instructions on how to recover that marriage, how to come back into the type of marriage that Yahweh intends for us, and how to behave in our broken down world. Now, there was a question that I received between the last recording and this recording that I wanted to go into a little bit. And the question was, what do I do as a woman if my husband is not interested in this? And, you know, I really want to apologize. I know I am speaking mainly towards men because realistically, the men have the biggest impact on a marriage because the women really, most women really want to have a good marriage. But the problem is that us men, we get caught up in the ways of the world. And especially in America today, where men have really been trained to act like a woman should, right? A man is supposed to be a giver. I'm supposed to give to my wife and not expect stuff in return. That doesn't mean I can't receive, but it means that that's my role, is to be the giver, and she's to be the receiver and the nurturer. Well, unfortunately, today, most men now, you know, it's all about, what do I get out of this relationship? Why aren't you doing what I want you to do? I need you to cook my food. I need you to go get my beer from the fridge while I'm sitting watching the TV, you know? And so my message is a lot directed towards men, and, you know, that's how Scripture is. You know, Yahweh, throughout Scripture, it's very male-centric because the male is supposed to be the suzerain. He's supposed to be the leader of the home. So Yahweh would speak to the leader of the home and not bypass that authority. Now, unfortunately, in our world today, that is not the case. There are husbands who are not believers, or husbands who just, you know, they're not really interested in stuff. So what is it that you women can do about that? Well, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 7 just really quickly. I'm not going to read over all of it. That's going to come later on in the series when we get into first century marriage. I'm really going to go into what Paul was speaking about and the culture in Greco-Rome at the time, because there was a difference between Judea and Yeshua's words, because he was speaking to the Jews in Judea, and Paul, who was speaking to the people in Corinth, who were Greeks and Romans, right? So when you look at 1 Corinthians 7, it speaks of a woman who has an unbelieving husband, and he thinks it well to live with her, let her not send him away. And that is some excellent advice. And let me go a little bit more in depth on that. What Paul is talking about here is that you should live peaceably with your husband or your wife, if you can. An unbelieving spouse, the goal there is to live peaceably. And there's an excellent book out there for the women. It's written by the same man who wrote this book, The Garden of Peace, which I highly recommend for any of you men who need marital advice on how to fix your relationship. I highly recommend this book. It's called Garden of Peace by Rabbi Shlomo Rush. And I'd mentioned it in the first part of this series. There's also a companion book for women. And, these ones say for women only, so I really haven't read much of it. I have read a little bit. My wife is reading it. But it's called Women's Wisdom, The Garden of Peace for Women. You should be able to get it on Amazon. Not sure about the pricing or whatever. I don't, obviously I don't get any kickback from recommending these books. I just want you to have the best resources to fix your marriage. But in this book, it's, just like the other one, it's very rabbinical. And you got to, chew the meat, spit out the bones. But make sure that the bones that you're spitting out are actually bones and not truths that you just don't want to embrace because it hurts your flesh. But the biggest thing from talking to my wife and having read a little bit about this in the book is for women that you really need to focus in on creating a peaceful home, right? The woman is the homemaker. She's the one who is, even in the ancient Near East, she ran the household. If there, that was where their business was, she would run that household business. And so if you focus on having that peaceful home and you're praying to the Father, now the Father is able to, through the peaceful home, he's now able to answer your prayers and now work in your husband's heart. And we'll talk a little bit how that that process occurs, because it's not going to be an instantaneous process. It's going to take time. And then the other thing, for women, listen to what I'm saying for the men. And when you start to see your husband acting in these roles that he's supposed to be acting in, encourage him, support him, continue to help him to develop into the leader that Yahweh intends him to be. All right, so we're going to go into the series, It Is Not Good for Man to Be Alone. So why are we using Genesis? Why is Genesis where we find this? Well, if you turn to Genesis 2:24, we see that God speaks of, let's go there real fast, Genesis 2:24, and it says, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Right? This exact sort of thing is quoted several other times in scriptures. In Malachi 2, verse 15, it speaks, did he not make one, right? Referring back to Genesis 2. In Matthew 19, where Yeshua is being addressed by the Pharisees, when they ask him about, is it okay to divorce your wife for any reason? What does he do? He first responds that, didn't you not read, the two shall become one flesh? He once again refers back to the book of Genesis as the paradigm for marriage. And then Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 verse 16 and also in Ephesians 5 verse 31, he again mentions the two becoming one flesh. And so we understand from this concept that that was what the scriptures intend to be our paradigm for marriage. If we want to know about marriage, we go back to Genesis to figure out what it's all about. And what does God intend our marriages to be? Does he intend them to be just a you know, a list of rules, just like the Torah has been taken to mean by so many people. No, he intends our marriages to be filled with passion. I want to read for you Proverbs 5, verse 19. And it reads, "A loving deer and a pleasant doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times, and be captivated by her love always." Always by her love. It's all about love. It's a matter of the heart. And remember, the heart is your intellect. It is going to have emotions, but it's also in your actions and in your every thought in your marriage. You should filter through that. How is this going to set with my wife or my husband? You know, becoming one flesh. And it's interesting. Did you know that the gematria, the Hebrew numerology, right? They have a number for each word. The gematria for the word ahava, which is love, is the exact same as the word echad, which means one. What does that teach us? It teaches us that when we love each other, and that love is, we also have that love for God, that we become truly one with each other and with God. And that's what God really intends for us. And so we'll see that a little bit later on. So let's go into a little bit of a background on the book of Genesis before we get started. What was Genesis all about? The book of Genesis was written by Moshe, right? Now, he may have gotten some of this information from other sources. There's a lot of speculation that books were handed down. But the plain simple fact of the matter is that Moshe wrote it, and it is not a history book. It contains history, but it teaches us lessons. And if you've ever studied into the book of Genesis really in depth, there is just so much you can get there. In fact, I mean, this is probably going to be about 2 to 3 hours here that I'm covering on Genesis 2 and 3, and I'm only looking at it from the marriage angle. There is so much more that we could be covering, but for the sake of time, we're not going to cover every single aspect. And that's something else I want to talk about real fast. When you're listening to what I'm hearing today, some of the verses that I bring meaning out of, they may not really jive with your understanding of that verse. But remember, our Father is perfectly capable of saying more than one thing in one single sentence. He can mean multiple things. And that's what the beauty of the Hebrew language is that I can believe the verse says something, and you can believe the verse says something else, and we can both be correct, because we're looking at it from a different angle. And so I just want to point out, I am only looking at it from the angle of the marriage. So, the ancient Near East. What makes the Bible different from the ancient Near East? This is the creation account, really. Genesis 1 was the creation account of the world, of the physical world, whereas Genesis 2 really focuses on the creationship of the relationship side of the world, the interpersonal relationship. And when we look at the different creation myths in the ancient Near East, something really starts to jump out at you, is that in almost all of the creation accounts, they talk about the world being formed through sexual acts. A lot of times it was an act of sex with the deity's self, or this one god existed and then he performed a sexual act on himself, and out came two more gods, and then they had intercourse, and basically the whole pantheon of gods was formed by sex, and then eventually man comes through, and so it all revolves around sex. And a lot of the pagan cults actually focused on sex. There was a lot of fertility cults where it was considered spiritual to go into the temple and you'd have sex with the temple prostitute. In fact, the word kadosh, right, we know that as set apart. But did you know that the word kadosh, the root word, is also used for a temple prostitute? Because she was a woman who was set apart for that specific use for the spiritual sexuality in their pagan culture. So it's very interesting. There was so much emphasis on sex, and God makes a very clear distinction in his Torah, right? The whole creation account. Not one single mention of sex in the creation account. In fact, it's not even until Genesis 4, well after the fall of mankind, that the first sexual act is actually recorded, right? It talks about that Adam knew Chava. And it's really interesting because that really isn't even a sexual term per se. The word there is yada, which means to know. And what that means is it is used as a euphemism for sex, but it's actually a covenantal term that means to recognize your position within the relationship. And so what it's literally saying is that Adam recognized his wife Chava, or Eve, as a lot of us know her. He recognized her position in the relationship as to be the mother, and therefore he gave her what she needed to fulfill her relationship. Not even really talking about the actual act of intimacy. And you know, throughout the Torah, God makes a very clear distinction. Have you ever wondered why there were no female priests? Because in the ancient Near East, there was always these female priests, and their role was to have sex with the male worshipers. And so God says, no, you're not even going to have any, you know, we're not going to mix any of that. That is cut off, out. Exodus 20, right after the Ten Commandments, he talks about that you do not approach the altar through steps, lest your nakedness be exposed. Not even the priests, you know, they could not have any nakedness being exposed during the worship service, because Yahweh wanted to make a clear distinction. Sexuality is part of creation and not part of the divinity, not part of divine worship. All right. So, the next part we're going to get into is the structure of Genesis. Genesis 2 is laid out in the structure of the ancient Near Eastern treaties. And it's a little bit loose, not as exactly laid out, but embedded here I have found the structure. And I really hope if you have not watched any of these series on the ancient Near Eastern treaties, I would highly recommend you go and you check out Rico Cortez's material on Wisdom and Torah. Or I have made a video myself called Introduction to Kingdom Covenants. And I would highly recommend going in and reviewing that material so that you can see how these ancient Near Eastern treaties were structured. How they did it is they had a preamble, they would do a historical prologue, they'd have stipulations, they would have sanctions, and then they would have a dynastic disposition. So when we go into Genesis 2, we see this structure embedded right in there. In chapter 2, verse 4, is the first time we see the term Yahweh Elohim. I'm going to read that here. It says, "These are the births of the heaven and the earth when they were created, in the day that Yahweh Elohim made the heavens and the earth." Now, have you ever wondered why the term Yahweh is found nowhere in Genesis 1? Because Genesis 1 is not actually laid out in the format of an ancient Near Eastern treaty. It does, I believe it is, speaking of a suzerain vassal relationship, and it's speaking of the treaties, but in and of itself, it is not a treaty. So when we get to Genesis 2, verse 4, this is the start of a treaty it's a marriage covenant, but it's also a covenant at the same time between Adam and Chava and Yahweh himself. And so whenever these ancient Near Eastern treaties would be formed, the first thing would be the preamble. And this is where the suzerain would describe himself and, in the pagan nations, they describe all their attributes, and it's designed to inspire fear and reverence in the person who they're coming into covenant with. And for example, in Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Commitments, as I really prefer the term to be, it starts out, "I am Yahweh your Elohim." And that's the entire preamble. That's all he had to say is Yahweh Elohim. Because the term Yahweh means covenant loyalty. And I know there's a lot of, there's a lot of people out there, especially, Jewish people, who do not use the term Yahweh out of respect for the name. But here, let me explain to you why I choose to use the term. And, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correct. I'm pronouncing it the best way I can. And I hope you don't fault me for that. But the reason why I use it is because each of the names of our God carries a different meaning. And when you look at Scripture, each time you read it, they all, if you understand the meaning, you start to understand how Yahweh himself is working. For example, the Leviticus 1 through 5 speaks about all the animal sacrifices. Did you know that not once is the term Elohim used? Every single time the term Yahweh is used. And what does that teach us? Yahweh is a term for covenant loyalty, for mercy. And so we're learning that the animal sacrifices are all about Yahweh's mercy, his covenant loyalty in the face of us acting improperly. The word Elohim speaks of his power and his judgment. And that's why Elohim is never used in the sacrifices, because the sacrifices were never about judgment. And that's something that is horribly misunderstood, especially within the Christian world, is that they were never about his judgment. They were about, oh, okay, you messed up and you want to actually come to me for forgiveness. Well, here's how I'm going to allow you to approach me for forgiveness. Those sacrifices were taken away because of our disobedience, not because of a reward, because we achieved something great and now we've earned something better. And Yeshua was definitely the better sacrifice, but that's a whole nother discussion. I'm not taking away from Yeshua's sacrifice, just so you know. I'm just trying to point out that the animal sacrifices were relevant and still are relevant, and will be relevant in the future when we do have a temple back in the millennial kingdom. So anyways, moving on here. The preamble, Yahweh Elohim is used here because he's describing who you're coming in covenant with. And then the historical prologue, chapter 2, verse 5 through 14, Yahweh describes the creation of Adam and how he was given a garden and all these wonderful things. And so with that, with these treaties, that was the historical prologue, was all the wonderful things that the suzerain, or the king of kings, gave to his vassal out of pure love. Adam did not earn anything to be created and given this. It was given freely as a gift. And so it's meant to invoke gratitude so that the vassal now willingly accepts the terms of the treaty. The next thing we come to is the stipulations, right? In verse 15, God gives Adam a job. He says, you are to work and to guard the garden. And then also in the first part of verse 17, speaking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he tells him, do not eat of the tree. So those were Adam's commandments. The next thing we get to are the sanctions. And the sanctions were broken down into blessings and curses. And so as you can see, the blessings are in verse 18 through 22. What are Adam's blessings? His wife. God gave him his wife as a blessing. And whenever Adam is acting properly, his wife will be a blessing towards him. But whenever he is acting incorrectly, now she's going to become a curse towards him. And so it's really interesting. God wrapped up the sanctions all in this wife that she gave him, or that he gave her. He gave to Adam, right? She's both blessings and she can be curses when he's acting improperly. And then we also see curses in the second half of verse 17, where if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. And then the last thing is the dynastic disposition. And the whole purpose of the dynastic disposition was basically instructions for continuing in the covenant. A lot of times this would have like covenant renewal, where you place the covenant. And not a lot of that is mentioned here, but there is one very key term. How to stay in covenant is what this is all about. Verse 24. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother. And so what Yahweh is saying here is that in order for continued working relationship, you, Adam, must leave your father and your mother and cleave to your wife. All right, so let's go ahead and move on, and we will get into the text now. We're going to start off with Genesis 1, verse 26 through 28, because there is a little bit about marriage here that we need to look into in chapter 1. So I'm going to read that, Genesis 1, verse 26 through 28. And it reads, "And Elohim said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over all the creeping creatures which creep on the earth. And Elohim created man in his image. In the image of Elohim, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And Elohim blessed them. And Elohim said to them, bear fruit and increase, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over all the creatures that move upon the earth." All right, so let's dig into this. What is he talking about here? The first thing he points out is the differentiation of the sexes, right? He specifically points out of all of creation, the only thing that he mentions having both male and female are the humans. And so it's interesting here that, you know, there are physical differences between us, but really not that much. You know, just, you know, in the animals, there's physical differences, but just from looking at a dog, you really can't tell if they're male and female. And, you know, assuming, say, a dog had the intelligence of us, if he looked at a human, he may not be able to tell the difference between male and female, especially nowadays. I mean, sometimes I can't even tell the difference between a male and a female, and that's pretty sad. But, you know, that's reality. But anyways, we are supposed to have a difference between us. And the difference isn't just the physical, it's the spiritual, it's the emotional. And we need to realize that and respect that and not expect our spouses to be the same as us. Women have very different emotional needs than men. And men have very different emotional needs than women. And if you treat your spouse like the way that you think that you want to be treated, things are not going to work out in your relationship. Because we're not created the same way. We have different needs. Women need nurturing and love, right? They need constant compliments and stuff like that. Whereas a guy, most of us really don't need compliments that often, you know? We need to be shown respect. We need to be made to feel more important. Not that, you know, and there's a lot of cross stuff there. But we need to recognize each other's differences, and especially we need to recognize each other's roles, right? Men are supposed to be the givers. That's the way God created us. And, you know, you can see that in our intimate relationships, that men give and women receive, and they nurture and they grow, and then, you know, they respond. That's the way that the role that God created for women. And when we try to reverse these roles, or we don't understand these roles, and we expect our spouse to act in a way that she or he was not created to act, we're going to face problems. As a parent, by, you know, our divorce rate in this country, well over 50%. The other thing, we need to understand that we are the image bearers of Elohim. We were created in his image, male and female in his image. So there's a couple different things we can gain from this understanding. First off, that if we truly want to be in his image, it needs to be male and female together with that shalom in the home and Yahweh in the relationship, a kind of a triangular thing, man, woman, and God, right? It's a triangle. That's actually the most stable geometric shape out there is a triangle. And isn't that interesting, as that's how God wants our relationships to be? And please don't, you know, oh, a triangle's pagan or whatever. I know that a lot of pagans use that, but let's be realistic here. God created geometry too. So, you know, that triangular relationship, the three people, is way more important. And, I just want to do a little sidebar here. I hope that, if you're divorced or single for whatever reason, please don't feel that I am attacking you. There's a lot of stuff in our past that we can't do anything about. We've all sinned. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. And so sometimes in our broken down world, we have to live without these things. And we can still have a great relationship. I mean, look at Paul, for example. We know contextually, there is no way he could have there is no way he could have stuttered under Gamaliel in the first century and been single. We know that he had to be married, which means, since he was single when he was writing his letters, that either his wife died, or more realistically, either she divorced him or he divorced her. And yet Paul, you know, went on to become an author of quite a few many of the books of Scripture. So, you know, it's not to say that being single is the end of the world, but it's not ideal, and it should be the exception and not the rule. All right, another thing here is that if we are in the image of Elohim, that means that God created us the way that we are for a specific purpose. And we need to accept who we are. You know, if we have some sort of what we consider to be a physical defect, we need to learn to accept that about ourselves and realize that the Father probably sovereignly chose to give us that in order to help correct some sort of part of ourselves, help us learn a lesson. Instead of being down on ourselves because, you know, I'm big boned, or you know, I don't have the most attractive face in the world, or whatever, you know, whatever problems you see with yourself, we need to realize that God created us that way, and we need to appreciate the way that He created us, because there's a reason for why He did that. And we may not know, but it's for our own good. And I want to point out Romans 9, verse 20. Let's go there real fast. Romans 9, verse 20. And it reads, "But who are you, O man, to talk back to Elohim? Shall that which formed say to him who formed it, 'Why have you made me like this?' Does not the potter have authority over the clay, from the same lump to make one vessel for value and the other not for value?" What Paul is saying is here is, stop complaining about who Yahweh made you. Who, you know, how, don't complain about your life. Learn from the trials and the tribulations that God put there for us, because that's why we're on this earth here, is to learn to correct our souls, to correct our character traits, our personalities, everything like that, to align ourselves with the Father so that one day we can actually have His presence literally dwelling inside of us, like it speaks of in the kingdom, right? Or in the after the kingdom. Remember, in the New Jerusalem, there's no temple because the Father dwells within each one of us. All right. Let's see. One more thing there I wanted to bring out is that we need to also accept in each other those differences. And realize, you know, that our spouses were created in such a way to help us out, right? If our spouse is, I don't know, loud and obnoxious, or is quiet and timid, right? They were created in a way that is going to help us, because I believe that the Father put our marriages together regardless of how we chose them, right? How many of you got married and have a completely boring story with nothing miraculous on how you got together? Probably very few. I'd venture to guess that there's a lot of things that just randomly happened, or seemingly randomly happened, that ended up getting you and your spouse together. Well, what was that? Was that just random chance? Or was that the hand of God, you know, leading Chava to you? I believe it was the hand of God. If it was the hand of God who gave you your partner in your marriage, then He gave you her for a specific reason, because she's going to fit with you. She's going to bring out those things in you that are for the best. And it can either be in a good way, or if you refuse to change when it's in that good, loving relationship, then the relationship is going to turn bad, and she's going to, you know, those bad things are now going to push you, are going to try to push you and give you that choice. Are you going to fix yourself, or are you going to continue living your life the way that you should not be living your life? And then the principle of the seed is what I like to call this. Here, as you can see, we have a picture of a baby developing. And this is a very interesting lesson. And I think this is really, really going to help some of you who you make changes and you don't see anything happening, right? I know a lot of people, and myself included. You know, when I first came in the Messianic walk, we'll use that for an example. I came in, I started believing, I mean, I was just studying scripture. That's all I wanted to do was just study the Word of God. And my wife wasn't interested, right? She agreed with me. She stopped shopping on the Shabbat. It was a little bit of a fight, but, you know, we gave up Christmas and everything pretty easily. But she really didn't respond the same way. She wasn't really interested in anything. And that really bothered me for a while. Why didn't she, I've made all these changes. Why hasn't she responded? And the same thing, after I started reading the Garden of Peace and implementing all these positive changes in my marital relationship, she didn't respond at first. You know, it took months, really, and, a couple of years now for our relationship to get where it's at. And we by no means have the perfect relationship. I will tell you that. We still fight occasionally, but, I will tell you, our fights have got fewer, and when they do occur, we usually fight for less than 15 minutes. Because we've learned, and it's this process, and really, that's for the better, because in that process of learning, of struggling back and forth and getting to the point, the positive point that we're at now, now we have all that stuff behind us, and we've been built up and we've grown in that way. And so I want to introduce what I call the principle of the seed. When a man and a woman come together in sexual intimacy, the man gives to his wife, right? He gives her, a small, relatively small amount of sperm, which now goes into her body, and she receives it into her body, right? She does not give him anything in return. All it is him giving, and now she receives that, and now it implants within her, and it starts to grow. And does she respond? No, she doesn't. She does not give anything back to him. In fact, now the man is going to have to spend 9 months continuing to give to her. Now he's got to give her back rubs. He's got to give her foot rubs. He's got to listen to her. Can become very emotional. Ladies, you guys can become very emotional when you're pregnant, or at least my wife can. So you've got to do that. You've got to increase your giving. You've got to give her more food, and you've got to give her some really weird food. I have no idea why God put that in your guys' mind, but for some reason, you ladies really can come up with some very interesting combinations of food while you're pregnant. But, us men, we have to continue giving. We continue giving without receiving anything. And as the time, as that time starts drawing near to an end of the pregnancy, what happens? Guys, we have to give even more. She becomes very emotional. She becomes very insecure with her weight. She's having back pain, right? We are just like in giving mode. We got to listen to her ranting, especially when they're in labor. They're screaming at you. They're yelling at you. They're saying things that, luckily that we as men, the scriptures allow us to override these vows. Things don't get any easier right away, and they get harder. But what happens, right? After 9.5 long, long, long months, she finally is able to hand you something that you were never able to give her to begin with. You gave her just a small amount of seed, and she gives you a baby, 7, 8 pounds, 10 pounds, however big your child is. She hands you this baby, and it's alive, and it's wonderful. And yeah, you're going to have to keep on giving, but she has given you something that you could have never gotten on your own, is the key thing here. And so we take this to the same principle I propose applies in our relationships and how we when we change, right? When I choose to change the way that I behave towards my wife, that implants a seed within her. And now that seed continues to grow. I become a man. I finally start giving to her. And she doesn't respond. She doesn't change. She's still arguing with me. She's still fighting with me. She still gets upset with me. That's okay. Because I know that seed is planted within her. And now it's going to continue to grow. And I'm going to have to nurture her. And by nurturing her, I'm nurturing this seed that's growing within her. And I continue to give. I continue to give. Until the very end, when she is finally to give me such a blessing back that I could have never imagined how incredible this blessing would be without her having given it to me. And so this same thing applies, or you know, this is the same thing that's going on with this marriage or this relationship. And what would happen now as a guy, if I were to start giving, I make my changes. And I've been giving to her, and it's 3 months into it, and you know, realize this is an allegory. This process may take a week, it may take a day, it may take a couple months, it may take years. But the point is that you've got to keep on giving, knowing that one day she will give back to you. And you know, and our goal or our motivation really should not be because we're trying to receive something back. That's the ladies are supposed to be the receivers. We're just supposed to be giving because it's good to give. But what would happen, let's say that this seed that I implanted in my wife will take 9 months to grow. What happens if at the 3 month point, I am sick of her fighting with me, I'm sick of her not responding to the changes I've made, and I go up to her and I go, "Woman, I demand that you start treating me with respect. I demand that you, you know, you start cleaning the house and you do this and that and you start worshiping, you start praying, you start reading the Bible, whatever it is." What would happen if I do that? The same thing that would happen if I went up to my wife who's 4 months pregnant and I said, "Woman, you will give me that baby now." And then I went ahead and proceeded to pull the baby out of the woman, right? And you can see here, I mean, look at this. This baby is not developed at this point in time. And so if I were to pull this baby out of the woman, it's going to be immature and it's going to die, right? And the same thing applies. Men, if we make these changes or if we make these changes in ourselves and our wife's not responding and we get upset about them, we start demanding a response right away, things are not going to go well, right? We're going to get an immature seed. Maybe she'll respect you for a little bit, but that is going to die. And that is going to leave the relationship in an even worse state than it ever was. We've got to step up and be a man. Ladies, how does this principle apply to you? What can you do in your relationship? What you need to do, like I was saying earlier, you focus on that shalom in the home, the peaceful home where you guys can just live together in harmony, because that way Yahweh can pour out those blessings. He can respond to your prayers. And how do you change your husband? Because you're not the giver. You pray to the Father, right? Because everyone has the relationship. Everyone has the right to pray to the Father. And so what you do is you pray to the Father. And then the Father responds to that. And he gives to, you know, you're asking the Father and he gives to you. What he does is now he implants that seed of change in your husband. And just like the same principle, it's a seed. It's not a fully developed change. And so now the seed will be planted and it's going to have to take time to grow. And you're going to have to continue to pray and to continue to support. And every time your husband acts the way that he should be acting, you've got to support and encourage him and really push for that godly character, that image of Elohim in him that you want him to be. And you will see eventually over time, I truly believe that Yahweh is true to his word and that if you ask, you will receive in time. Once that seed has blossomed in your husband, now your relationship will improve beyond any thing you've ever imagined it to. All right, so let's go ahead and take a break here. When we come back, we're going to go into Genesis 2, and that will probably take another whole video, and after that, we'll go into Genesis 3. So until next time, shalom. He still speaks from heaven each and every day. I'll let Yisrael say.